The program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is time for the True Wealth radio show on this, the greatest Tuesday you've had all week. And of course, in studio joining me today, I've got my main man,
Matt Dixon.
I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and we have a special guest joining us. He's been here many times, but it's been a long time. Welcome back.
Thank you. I think there should be intro music. I'm Derek Simmons.
Yes, I think there should. I'll get right on that as soon as I get the custom intro music I've been looking for.
I appreciate that.
It's only been 10 years, right? Well, welcome back, everybody. I know that it's been a long 7 days since our last show, but we're excited to be here and we're excited to share with you. Today, I have a surprise topic. Derek, are you ready for this?
I love surprises.
Okay, the surprise is we're going to be talking today about the concept of the invisible scorecard.
Cool.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure I'm way ahead, but I can't check that out for sure.
Well, the beauty of it is, one of the things we'll discuss is that the invisible scorecard, everybody has their own. The question is, how did we arrive at this? Right? Because that's always kind of a puzzler. Like, why do we have this scorecard? And who's tracking it? You know, how do you win or not? So this is a fun one because I think that a lot of folks have, because of the invisible scorecard, they can sort of taunt themselves into financial decisions that are not necessarily in their best interest or even aligned, but it's because the psychology of what they're doing is working against them and they don't even know it.
That's no fun.
So we're going to unpack this a little bit today. And the first one is the idea that, you know, sometimes our brain will tell us things that we are like, well, this is clearly a good thing, but it's not necessarily a good thing. Okay. It is the idea that you may shorten the time horizon for a decision or otherwise do the math to make it temporarily feel good. Translation, I'm going to rationalize something dumb or bad and say it's okay.
We're really good at that.
Yeah, we're super good at it. Okay. One of the first things is a lot of us have this idea that I want the instant gratification and I'm not going to think about the impact of the decision until later. This can happen in tiny decisions, it can happen in big ones. Matt.
Yeah.
When I think about big decisions that end up being big problems. What are some things that come to mind?
Big vehicle purchases. You know,
so I thought the exact same thing. I'm right? Like, oh, like, the big truck.
But it smells so good.
Well, especially when vehicle prices are, you know, six figures today. It's not uncommon. You want to go get a brand new F-350 diesel? You can spend $100,000 really, really easily if you're not getting a base
model.
Pretty
fast. Yeah.
But it smells so good.
Does it?
It really does.
But it's not even European leather. David.
Yeah, it's Corinthian leather, right? That was the old.
I think a new car smell thing rotating about underneath my mirror is almost as good, but not quite.
Yeah. Well, I think the bigger issue here is, believe it or not,
but
it's
it feels
not automatically
like
a bad decision to get a new vehicle.
No, it's not. But like people, I think it's the dopamine hit, right? Because you kind of get that rush of like, oh, I got this thing. However, do you get that same feeling if you increase your retirement plan contribution 1%?
Incidentally, I think maybe we should invent a soft drink and call it Dopamine Hit and just see how it sells. What do you think?
Just dopamine. Yeah.
Dopamine.
Okay, Derek, you see this pen? I'm writing down all your good ideas
all right, good.
Today. And
yeah.
Then we're going to
that's
form
the first
some new
one. It's like, and people, when they could say later on, like, yes, I'm on dope. and it's true.
Derek,
it's like naming a bar the library, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to the library.
You can open LLCs for people, right?
I can.
Okay, so I'm writing down all these LLCs as we
okay,
speak.
Good.
I've got a list. Dopamine.
We have a list. Dopamine's pretty fun. That, by the way, should go into our secret project.
Okay.
right? Some not so secret parts of it. You could, I'll let Derek say. We have random side projects that are just purely for fun.
Moo-hoo-hoo, ha-ha-ha.
Yeah, and it does come with that laugh. So the big purchase thing, the bigger issue is not the purchase. It's the timing or when you actually can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem, is that people will go out and they'll the afford it thing, that has got to be one of the biggest issues that we run into, is folks want the appearance that they can afford something, but they can't.
And I think a lot of the times people don't really have a way to gauge that, and so they just kind of use the force, whatever it is at the time, and then it's like, well, maybe I can't really afford it, but they make a justification as to why they think that they can.
I think the prevailing theory, and this is not for everybody, plus fortunately, our listeners are smart.
Sure.
All those people that aren't listening that are idiots, right? Those people are the ones that we got to worry about. Now, I mean, the idea that I have this much money in my paycheck, and then I just start saying, like, my budget is, as long as my paycheck covers all of the recurring expenses, I'm okay. You know, I make this much money and I've got this much for my rent or my mortgage. I have this much for my insurance. I have this much for my toys. I have this much for my food and for this and for that. And if the number at the end is positive, I'm good. Until you forget to put something in the budget or something disrupts your income. And then you're not good.
People wonder how major sports athletes that sign $100 million contracts run out of money. And it comes down to the same basic principles, whether, you know, you're making $60,000 a year or $6 million a year.
Well, you know, there's a super hidden component to this, too, that we don't really talk about very often. And it is, you could buy something thinking that it's going to store value, but it's not. You're buying a melting ice cube. Vehicles are really like that a lot of the time. Is you buy one, and there's a certain amount of the purchase is utility. It gets you places. But then there's social clout, and there's other features that aren't necessarily any more utility. It's just more expensive. And, you know, the penalty, as soon as you buy a new car and you drive it off the lot, it's worth significantly less typically.
Yeah.
Right? There are very few vehicles that appreciate in value. And this, by the way, I want you to I'm surprising Derek with this, but I'll bet you he's going to nail it. Okay, you were the one that gave me this theory about collectible items, okay, and how, like, peak value on collectibles.
No, tell me what it was.
It was about a guitar.
Oh, yeah, that's okay? Right. Yes.
So can you explain to our listeners the concept of, like, optimal pricing?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I will actually tell you about this item. I bought at a charity auction an autographed Rolling Stones guitar, and it was pretty cool. I mean, the actual Rolling Stones, and they drew the lips and the tongue and everything. It was very cool. But it occurs to me that is really going to be at its peak value only for about 6 months after Mick Jagger dies.
Yeah.
Because as time goes along, I mean, the Stones were not the Beatles. They were not Elvis. And so over time, the value of that's going to decline as the people who valued that also die off.
Do you think that this also will happen with, like, classic cars, like the 60s?
It's already happening.
Yeah.
I can tell you that because I own a classic car and I've been tracking the value, and I see that people are getting less money for restored cars than they used to, because the people that buy them are aging out. It's a nice way of saying they're dead.
Right.
And the younger generations don't care.
Well,
you don't get somebody that was born in the 80s that wants to buy a car that was manufactured in the 50s or 60s.
It doesn't have the same nostalgia.
Well, they have no connection to it.
Right, yeah.
And the feature sets are arguably inferior to modern vehicles.
They're definitely. I always thought it would be cool to get, like, a Model T and then put air conditioning
and people do
cruise
it.
Control.
They do modernize them. They take a classic car and they put, you know, new modern equipment inside of them, so they drive and do a lot better. But I'm like, why don't you just buy a new car?
Well, it's less cool, but I get your point.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you could do that, but even the younger generation doesn't even necessarily think it's cool. That's the wild thing about it. They're like, well, no, I want to see, like, a brand new exotic Italian sports car that's, you know, $500,000. That's cool. But a classic muscle car, you know, unless they're raised around people that pretty appreciate them, they're kind of like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, my kids don't get that the classic convertible muscle car is cool. They know it is because I tell them it is, but they don't think it's
they
cool.
Know it, but they don't feel it.
Exactly.
And they're not going to spend their hard-earned money buying it from you.
Yeah, and so this is an issue. Again, when we talk about the scorecard, by the way, this is, you know, you do math in your head. No, it's super valuable. But if nobody else agrees with you, guess what? It's only super valuable to you, which means you'll pay a lot for it, but nobody else will pay a lot to take it from you.
You know, I see this a lot in estate planning where folks come in and they're talking about what to do with their assets when mm-hmm. they die. And I've got this really cool collection of whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids don't want it. And my fear is, they always say, that I'm going to die and there's going to be an estate sale and it's going to be sold for garage sale prices when really it's worth way more than that. Well, we don't know what it's actually worth. But you don't find out unless you're dealing with somebody who likes it, who's going to be kind of your vintage.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fascinating. And also, a lot of the time, that kind of purchase, when it's not established to broaden a market, like, why do things sell at garage sale prices? Typically, the perception is that there's a whole lot of the stuff out there, so it's not that precious, and therefore, let's just move it along because you're paying for somebody else to take it away. That's a lot of what's happening. The person that is savvy goes to the garage sale and recognizes an item of particular value that somebody else is just expediting the liquidation.
Do you think some of the problem is there's just so much stuff that it would take an eternity to sell it all off? And had that person maybe like started to liquidate some stuff and make the collection smaller, then you might take more time to get top dollar for those things? You kind of get the angle there?
I think there's some of that. But,
yeah.
But let me use a different theory around it. It's like if you go... A lot of people don't know much about watches. I don't know about that much. You know, if I say Rolex, everybody's like, "Well, that's an expensive watch." But if you pick some other brand that you've never heard of mm-hmm. that might be very valuable, but nobody knows about it, that could get sold in a garage sale or estate sale environment for pennies on the dollar, and then it could be taken somewhere and discovered that it was actually a vintage valuable piece.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like Antique Roadshow, where you're like, "Oh, you found a thing that's really rare and impressive."
Mm-hmm.
Parties involved didn't know better, so they liquidated it based on the knowledge they had, but they had incomplete knowledge.
So I think this is where AI is actually going to really take a big leap. When people start realizing there's an app now where you can, and it's meant for collectible stuff, you can just scan your phone over it and your camera's looking at it, and then it's running through Google Images and eBay and all the different outlets, and it's determining values in real time as you're running a video. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, it'll be interesting because I'm going to go back to Derek's theory, which is it's valuable because there are other people that want to collect it too.
Mm-hmm.
But value is in the perception of the transaction, like the buyer and the seller. That's what determines the price, is what the seller's willing to sell it for and the buyer's willing to pay for it. If there are no buyers, then there's no value. And that's the issue. Like, Rolex ceases to be valuable if in the future nobody cares. They don't want it.
What do you guys think might be one of those things that now has quite a bit of value that in the future?
Hold that question. We're running long. We will grab a break.
I've got
one. We'll come back
too.
And I want to answer that question. Stick around. So what are things
ready,
that you think will not have value?
I'm ready.
We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
That is a fun one to bring back up. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon
and
Derek Simmons.
Okay, and we had a question. If you're just joining us today, we're beating around the bush on this topic, but the idea is that there's an invisible scoreboard. And we're going to get back more to that, but there was this question that was posed at the break. Thinking about things, and here's the context, right? The scoreboard of like, how are you deciding things like your net worth or whether you need to do something? We make these financial mistakes that are unintentional. Some of the time it is buying things that end up not having value in the future.
Trying to put a point on the board.
And so it's like, let me buy a big truck, and then it's a depreciating asset that you couldn't afford, and you actually handicapped yourself financially, and you kept yourself from making other quality decisions because you just needed to look cool. You didn't need that truck. You wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you advanced everything to get to it, and then it, you know, ends up nipping you for it. So there are decisions like that. But the question was, hey, what are some things that may have been at peak value and are declining from this point? And, you know, Derek, you talked about the guitar.
Right.
That you have. This is a collector edition, but that someday, if the people aren't around that knew the band and wanted the item, it will be past peak value and start declining because less demand.
Arguably, Keith Richards is immortal or has been dead for a long time, one or the other. So maybe the Stones, the Stones are a little bit separate in that respect. But yeah, that's the question.
Yeah.
When people no longer want them, they are worth less.
Yeah. So the question then, what are some things that you think may be at peak value and decline? Now, by the way, this is not investment advice, nor is this anything that comes back to haunt you. This is just, you know, BSing on air for a moment about it. But I just, what do you think are some things that might not have value in the future that people think are valuable today?
What do you got, Derek?
Bitcoin.
Matt said that at the break. I was like, that's a good one. Bitcoin is, all right, why do you think that?
Well, because I still don't know what it does.
Okay.
I mean, it has value because we agree it has value. But when you look at the underlying asset, what is it? And I do not understand it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's incredibly valuable.
I'm kind of in the same boat.
But I don't understand it. And so, until I do, I can't assign it a high value.
It's funny because I do understand a fair amount about it. And because I understand it, I actually disagree with a lot of the premises that people have. It's true that Bitcoin is secure.
For now.
It probably stays pretty secure.
Ooh, I'm on this bandwagon of thinking that quantum's really going to be able to.
I've posited that, but I'm not certain because quantum has the ability to solve things really fast, but I don't know if it has the ability to print things really fast.
I think it'll have the ability to hack things really fast.
It's not a hack, though. Think about this. Imagine if you had 10 people in a room and everybody was staring at the same shared document and somebody makes a change and all 10 people have to agree to the change for it to happen. Okay, then you have to convince 10 people or you have to convince 6 out of the 10 to make that change. Okay, if you have 100 people, you have to convince 51 out of 100. That's a lower percentage threshold than 10, but it's a lot more people. So it takes more work to convince 51 people than 6. Now, Bitcoin is distributed over tens of thousands, if not millions, of computers. So even with Godzilla-level processing power through a quantum computing, from a solving perspective, can it write to all of the hard drives of 51% of the computers out there, or 50 point something percent, to convince them all that the ledger has changed and they all then agree to it?
Now, Dave, I'm going to just tell you that I understood each one of those words individually. They sounded like English. Did not track how that applies to the discussion.
The point is that could Bitcoin be corrupted? I'm not going to say no, but I'm saying I don't know that quantum computing, like it's really good at hacking sequences and things like that for cryptology, but I don't know if it's really good at being able to hijack over 50% of the computers in the world to overwrite their record.
Okay, so quantum computing is a threat to Bitcoin, which I still don't know why I care about Bitcoin.
Well, we care because the claim of Bitcoin is that it's secure, it is unique, it is a digital token that cannot be duplicated, and therefore it is the government can't control it, it's disconnected from all of the fiat systems, and therefore it's a reasonable proxy to behave like digital gold because it's scarce and it's... you can't counterfeit it.
I guess to be fair, the only reason that dollars have value is that we agree they have value.
Yes, but there's also one key difference. Okay, dollars have value because we have people with guns that will point them at you and say, dollars have value, right?
I don't think I've encountered that.
You haven't had to because you agree.
Huh.
But when other countries say dollars have value, right? Or we say that to them and they're like, I don't know if we have value. It's like, well, you could use your currency, but we're all going to trade oil in dollars, right? I mean, it takes a lot more to change people's mind, especially if another country doesn't have a military and says, by the way, you'd like our help, right? And they go, yeah. So we agree the dollars are cool? And they're like, okay.
I don't know if that's the process that we've followed.
I think that there's some elements at play here that I'm illustrating less about foreign policy than I am about the fact that Bitcoin can't defend itself. If a if our government said, you know what, Bitcoin's illegal, what are you going to do? It becomes black market. You can keep using it, but it's still black market now. They did this in China, by the way. China said no Bitcoin. You know, and so there's black market transactions.
Bitcoin's a hard one because, like you said, there's regulations.
And the government can't really stop it, but they can make it dangerous to use.
Yeah.
And so that's the issue. It's like they could screw it up so it doesn't fit in the mainstream financial system anymore. That, you know, they could legislatively squash things, just like they can anything else. They All can right. put regulations in business and
so
kill it.
So maybe Bitcoin wasn't the best example. Baseball cards.
That one, to me, seems like easy one. That who's going to want baseball cards in 50 years?
Right now, I know everybody, all the young people at my house are excited about Pokemon and Magic cards.
Yeah, and maybe, or maybe it'll be digital and people won't care about that either.
But they definitely aren't baseball cards.
It's interesting because it's a generational collectible. And the issue is what happens when the generation is gone.
Yeah.
And I think that's your larger point, is that like an Elvis or a Michael Jackson or kind of a, you know, a once in a generation talent that somehow gets codified into culture and becomes a historical icon. Yeah, we keep collecting that kind of stuff a little bit. But even then, like the Elvis plate collection isn't as valuable as it was 30 years ago.
All right, let's try moving away from collectibles. What's sure. another thing that is going to be worth less than we think it is? I stole all of Matt's easy ones, so now.
Yeah, I think during the break I said fine China. I could see that one.
Well, you know, and maybe I'm thinking with too big of a swath here because I'm like, well, fine China feels like collectibles to me.
Yeah, it kind of.
But
does.
There are more of those items that kind of fit in that category. You know, I think there's a lot of things that end up being socially novel, and so they're trendy items, and then they come and they go.
Yeah.
You know, your cell phone, you know, a lot of technology is going to sunset to be, there'll be new technology and the old stuff's just kind of, it's not a collector's item. You know, if you have a Commodore 64, it's novel. But if you have a IBM 486, they're like, who cares? It's trash. You know, I'm like, we don't want your CRT monitor or your dot matrix printer. You know, those things are just in the boneyard.
I do have my late 1990s Apple with no internal hard drive.
It's a classic.
Why am I keeping it? Because I can't bring myself to throw it away.
Yeah. But
I think some of that stuff is actually starting to become valuable again. Like if you look that up, people are wanting it because it's becoming more and more rare because everyone threw them in the garbage.
But that's kind of Gen X collectibles,
mm-hmm.
right? The Apple IIe was the thing that I grew up on. And, yeah. you know, you're like, what's an Apple IIe? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, like, because there's a generational gap between us. And so I get it. And you're like, huh? I mean, did you play Oregon Trail growing up?
I did, actually.
Okay. We all know.
It was like fourth, fifth grade.
Yeah. So it's a thing in our region. But if you were in Florida, they're like, Oregon Trail, what are you talking about?
I bet you they still played it.
There's your next idea opportunity. Somebody needs to modernize Oregon Trail and make it app based so you can just play it on your phone.
I actually think we'll see. So, did you play many video games at all?
Yeah, I was a nerd.
Okay. I think they've ruined video games. That's my hot take of the day. Everything is now you got to pay $30, $40, $50 a month, whatever it costs.
By God, when Matt was a boy, right? This wasn't a problem.
And yeah, right? You used to go and you'd get the actual copy of the game and you were good to go. now everything's just like you got to download it digitally and you got to pay a certain amount a month to connect to it. I think we see a resurgence in physical games come back.
Well, I'm not willing to make that wager, but it's fascinating because I've read some psychology around the games. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues is that games today don't have an end. They just keep building bigger world. It just keeps expanding. Hmm. Versus the games of my generation, which were mash the buttons hard and fast, and if you die, you have to start over again.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a certain amount of persistence and sort of dealing with frustration that was taught out of that.
Yeah.
And the psychology of the day is that, generationally speaking, there's not the same persistence in frustration with the younger generation. And then, right. Well, they didn't and have games that were yeah. designed to make them fail, and then they had to, like, dust themselves off and go try again.
I think you're onto something. The games now are super complicated. And back in the day, it was a lot more simple. And it was a way to just easily relieve some stress. And now it's like the new games cause stress.
But you also just save a point, and if you die, you just go back to that save point and mm-hmm. try again. You know, it's not the pain of completely starting over.
Yeah.
That's why most of us knew the Contra code, because having 30 lives was way better than having 3.
What were your guys' favorite games?
Oh, man.
I definitely had a code in... It wasn't a code. It was a pattern in Pac-Man.
Oh, that's okay. My wife's favorite game, Mrs. Pac-Man.
When I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
Were you good at it?
I beat the game. I mean, it was it was a pattern that would work over and over and over. You know, different for each screen, but...
I did that with Asteroids on Atari.
Ooh, yeah.
I played that game.
Atari is what I'm talking
until
about.
Until I scrolled the score. Like, it went back to 0.
That's
it's
cool.
It's like, what do you do now? It's like, well, it's as fast as it'll go, and the score looped around, and they're like, you rolled the odometer, dude. And then it's like, well, now what? We did that with Duck Hunt, too. We got that to, like, the, oh, you know, just all
I
of you, like, well,
game.
Got all the ducks. Now what? So.
And so I've got a certificate on my wall at home stating how good I am at Pac-Man.
At one point, I had a picture of when I actually TKO'd Mike Tyson.
Oh, hey.
That was another one that, like, who does that? So you had to play a lot of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out to have that happen.
Microsoft, if you're listening, bring back the simple video games. Like, make the Xbox simple again.
I don't think you get to be the old guy in this particular booth,
it's
Matt.
True.
I know.
Yeah, I think
you guys did grow up in a different era there.
I don't think you get to be that young either. Jeez. All right, look, speaking of running old here, we're running long on the segments. Let's do this. We're going to grab a break. We will come back, and somehow we are going to get to the invisible scorecard, I think. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where I, your host, Dave Littlejohn, am with superior individuals today. In studio with me,
Matt Dixon.
And
Derek Simmons, who wants to tell you about something.
Tell me about something.
All right. We, Simmons Law PC, are a sponsor of UACT, Umpqua Actors Community Theater, which is just about to start its run on Frozen. Frozen the Musical, which is going to be presented at RHS over the next 3 weeks.
The beloved Disney adaptation?
That is right.
Okay.
Let it go, Dave. Let it go.
I
had to be the first to say that. But what I wanted to do was...
I'm having trouble letting it go now.
I wanted to invite our listeners to go for free. Come be a guest of Simmons Law. We have 20 tickets at my office. And if you call and reserve one, we will give them to you free. Now, they're only good for Wednesday, July 22nd. That's tomorrow night.
Right. So if tomorrow night, what time does it start?
It starts, the curtain opens at 7, so you want to be there at 6:30.
So, yeah, you want to get there like 6:30, 6:40, and how do they get the tickets?
They can get them from my office. If you call ahead, 541-677-7185.
Okay.
We'll save tickets for you. And I've got 20 to give away.
Okay, so everybody heard this here, right? I also encourage you to benchmark this in your mind, because the attorney is giving things away.
I know, it's counterintuitive, isn't it?
Right. Like, I thought they advised against that in school.
No, gift, particularly if it's good for estate tax purposes.
Okay, great. So this is a gifting strategy, and in this case, community gifting. So actually, if you've never been to UACT Productions, we also, Little John Financial also is a sponsor. It's a lot of fun. It's the productions are often, I mean, they're surprisingly good for community productions. And this one, I think, will be really interesting because it's the tweener size. They've held them out at UCC before, this time being at the Rose Theater, right?
The Rose Theater at RHS,
which is a great size, and the stage is a great size. I'm actually really looking forward to this, to go and enjoy that. So it should be fun.
And it's tomorrow night, though, so call sooner rather than later.
Yeah, this is actually going to be pretty popular. We had a block of tickets, and they were all spoken for. So if you're trying to figure out, and by the way, there are probably some other parts of the production that you might be able to buy tickets for, but they may be getting close to not available too. So this is a big deal.
Yes. And then that gives you a bonus checkmark on your scorecard that you cannot see.
Right. So that's a great segue to scorecard. So one more time, the phone number, if they want to call to reserve tickets.
541-677-7185.
Okay. Everybody, you know, lock that one in. Now, the scorecard thing. Let's get back to that. When I ask you about scorecard, what do you think, Derek? What's the invisible scorecard? Without any definition, what do you think it means?
I think it means how I feel about myself when I'm looking at the stuff I've got.
Okay, I like this definition. Matt, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I think some of it is, too, you're measuring yourself against other people a little bit, right? And it's like, oh, well, is this thing that I have cooler than this other person's? Yes, put a notch on my scorecard because I one-upped them, so point me.
Isn't that fascinating? I think you've both hit on the broad components there. Unscripted, that's my favorite. So, Derek, I really agree with you that out of the gate, it's this, you know, you're establishing it, right? You don't know where it necessarily came from. We could have a whole long psychology unwrap about why do you feel that way? But it's this sense of, okay, I'm measuring things to determine whether or not I'm okay with them.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of in my office, I'm not the guitar I enjoy, but I have an autographed basketball signed by the 2023 Kansas Jayhawks basketball team. And every time I see that, I go, man, that's cool. Mm-hmm. It's cool. And so then I get a little dopamine rush from that. And I view that as a point on my scorecard without comparison to anybody else.
Gotcha. Mm. So, you know, I'm going to share something kind of personal that it took some years to work through. But early in our marriage, now my wife is from Portland and we would go up to visit her family. And when I would go to Portland, I used to feel like I would see a lot of what was going on. And this was a while ago. You know, we've been married for over 20 years. And so we were heading up there when I think the economic activity was a little stronger.
Right.
And I would see this and just think, man, I'm not locking in. I'm not achieving where I expected to be for this point in my life. And I felt sort of almost less than. And I don't know. I mean, it was entirely self-generated, though. I looked at it and thought I was supposed to be further along in my career. Other things were supposed to be happening. And then I would view myself as a failure. And nobody told me that. Mm-hmm. I conjured it. It was right. An invisible scorecard of expectations that I had set for myself somehow that I wasn't meeting.
Yeah.
And when I look back on that, I think that is one of those examples of what was a really negative scorecard that drove some of my behaviors. And I kind of wish I could have talked to the younger version of me and straighten him out a little bit. Time has helped, right? And as some maturity and perspective, but that there was a season of that. It's like, well, why was that scorecard there in the first place? You know, so.
Well.
Yeah, I think it's a lot maybe harder, but healthier if you're not comparing yourself to other people.
I think that that's hugely important to understand that the scorecard is basically a recipe to trap you in the game of more. You know, you're going to measure.
The American consumer has been pushed that a lot, right? Like, how many times has someone bought a house not because they needed a better house, but they just wanted to have a better house than someone else, right? It's
the,
pushed on
the
us.
Whole keep up with the Joneses
yes,
thing.
Exactly.
Well, but where does I think that probably comes from people themselves. I don't think that's a society thing. That's a I want to win.
Well, yeah. I think there's a competition element. And the other, though, it's not that it's a society thing, and I think we have to own this. So I want to be careful the way this is framed, but you know, advertising incentivizes us to think that we need something that we maybe don't need.
Hmm.
But you know, they paint this life that's it's got to be better than what I'm going through. Look at these people that have this amazing experience. It's sort of the lie of like Facebook and Instagram. You know, people show you only their best moments, and they're curated to look great.
Mm-hmm.
They don't show you the terrible moment. I mean, some people do, but most people don't, right? Most of the time, they're like, look at this amazing life I have. And then you look at it and go, wow, by comparison, my life looks kind of vanilla here. Maybe I'm missing something. And so there's a lot of FOMO that gets generated around that. And, you know, I don't know about you, but it's today I look at that and go, great, I'm glad you're having that moment. But I'm fully aware that there are other elements of their life that are not I mean, I've been on great vacations and there's still some pretty miserable moments during great times,
right?
Sometimes, you know, like people win a trophy, there's this trophy idea behind it too, right? Like you're mm-hmm. in a sporting event, you win a trophy, you feel good about it. Sometimes you didn't win the trophy, so you go out and you try and buy the trophy, right? Like whether it's the classic car or whether it's the whatever it is, you're buying it not because you necessarily really really want it, you want other people to see it.
Yeah, but here's the funny thing about going out and trying to buy these things. And honestly, even the trophy.
Mm-hmm.
Most research will affirm this too, that somewhere in the next 6 months or so, you just
yep.
become used to it. It's, mm-hmm. it's there's actually a term for it. It's called hedonic adaptation.
Yep.
So if you've ever heard the, you know, the term hedonistic, right, or being mm-hmm. a heathen, right, it's this idea of, it's sort of a seeking of a carnal pleasure thing, mm-hmm. but hedonic adaptation, that's the root of it. And it's the idea that we actually get used to something and then it becomes normal and then you need to chase more in order to try to reclaim that feeling that you had from the initial success, which is surprisingly short-lived.
You know where else I get a check mark on my invisible scorecard?
Tell me.
Is when I get my quarterly retirement plan statement. Now, this sounds boring as hell. I know that. But
and it's also, I'm like, where is this going to go?
I know,
this
yeah.
could be good or bad or anything, anything.
Well, you know, I've been working with you for like 20 years. And sure. early on, it was a much lower number. And then every time I see it, oh, my God, look how much that's grown.
Mm-hmm. And you don't check it daily.
I don't check it daily. That's not helpful at all.
Yeah. You know, let's do something here. This is a really opportunity. I want to remind people that there are three phases. Mm-hmm. In retirement, like three big benchmarks that and I think if you know about them, it kind of changes your perspective on retirement. And these might be actual things that maybe that you can make an invisible scorecard a little bit more visible.
But you're not going to tell us what they are.
Well, I will, but we got to take our last break. Okay, so let's do that. This one, I don't normally like really tease something that hard. You should stick around. This could really help you reframe retirement in a way that motivates you. All right, so stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. On News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio today with
Matt Dixon
and Derek Simmons.
And we have been talking about the invisible scorecard and then weird stuff. Bitcoin, baseball cards, classic cars, guitars, Rolling Stones.
Kansas Elvis. Basketball.
And
Kansas
frozen.
Basketball. We haven't talked about castles yet, but the day is not over. So, I wanted to talk to you because, Derek, you brought up the idea of on your scorecard, the updates looking at the retirement plan and seeing it move over
seeing it
really
grow
decades.
Over years and decades.
Yeah,
yes.
And I wanted to bring up three things to maybe help people to understand how to really dial their time frame on this. And let me just go through it quickly. When you first start putting money into a retirement plan, you put more money into it than the interest it earns. And so your contributions are the thing that grows the account. And that isn't terribly satisfying because it's basically great. That's my money sitting there.
It's a savings account, yeah. It feels like.
And so no big deal, but there you go. Over the years, as you make contributions and the interest slowly starts to build up, the next phase of this is that the interest starts to exceed your contributions. It grows more than what you're putting into it. And that's an emotional milestone for people when they realize I've been putting in for years and this thing is starting to do the lifting for me. And so that's phase two of the launch and it feels pretty darn good. What's phase three?
Phase three is when the income in your retirement plan exceeds the wages that you're making.
Exactly.
And then you can just clock out.
There comes a day when it will grow to the point that it exceeds more than you are earning. And at that point, you are sort of broadly speaking, you are air quotes retired, right? You are no longer working for the money is working for you. And that's a neat way to think about it is where are you on that chain? Because the earlier you start, the sooner you get to the part where the money's earning more than you do. Now, notice that's your earnings, not your spending, right? You could still outspend that. That's not what I'm saying, but those three phases are pretty significant. And so if you're not sure where you're at, that's where I would say, talk to a planner. And if you don't have one, we know, guys. Matt, shameless plug?
Yeah, how about 541-375-0898 or go to littlejohnfs.com.
Right. So this is where you start to take some of the invisible scorecard and make it a little bit more visible by putting goals on there. And it's valuable to assess, like, what are the things on your scorecard and do they really matter, right? Is it like I've always, wanted to get this boat or a house somewhere or, whatever the thing or the widget is, right? I have to earn this much money. I don't know what it is. I've always wanted this many kids. I mean, there are things that you put out there. I'm not saying they're bad things,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying absent context and understanding why you put them there, they could be there for the wrong reasons, or they could be demotivating if they're not framed well.
Yeah.
Or they could incentivize bad decisions, right? I've always wanted to, be a rock star and, don't start with the drugs.
<You're right.
laughs> there you go.
I think one of the keys there is just starting to create some wins that nobody sees, right? That's a kind of a powerful concept because you can do a lot of different things that isn't super flashy, but actually does ring the meter on your scorecard, right? Like
sure.
Paying off debt and not really talking about it. You just paid it off. You moved on to actually saving more than you're spending. Like
yep.
There's a lot of little things that you can do that make a big
upgrading your skill set so that you're more valuable to your employer.
Mm-hmm.
That, by the way, that's pretty huge. If you're self-employed, you still need to consider this. But upgrading your skill set, man, the world's changing. AI is replacing parts of jobs, not whole jobs necessarily, although sometimes it does.
Yeah.
But you need to upgrade your skill sets so that you're valuable, so that you continue to be relevant as the economy evolves.
Sometimes you can notch a win just by walking away from a bad deal.
Yes. Yeah. Having the mm-hmm. willingness to say no to something that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
The discipline.
Yeah. A lot of people are easily persuaded into a bad decision. So.
Yeah. Matt, don't be so hard on yourself. You worked out fine at the firm.
I know. Thanks.
It is a sweet truck, though. I just have to say.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I guess I think we've said enough about the invisible scorecard. The visible side of it, though, that's the one that, or maybe we say make it visible.
Hmm.
Right? If you make your scorecard more visible. So this is the whole goal setting thing. And it's amazing how you want to know how you can become more successful immediately. Start writing down the things you want to do.
Yeah. And then check them off as you get there.
Yeah. It is amazing how just putting things on a list starts to make them happen. Now, if you put it on a list, actually, you put it on a list and throw the list away. It still strangely seems to make more of it happen. Your productivity goes up when you write stuff down. But yeah, if you, and don't write too many things down. You write 600 things on the list, then
you will never get
list,
it done.
Then the list itself is overwhelming. Write two or three things and do them. And then if you get them done, make another list. It's amazing how picking a direction and following it works. In fact,
because once you finalize the list, it kind of eats at you in the back of your mind because you know it's there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of an old navigation trick if you think about this. I can recall learning orientation or orienteering in scouting. And so if you get plunked in the woods and you need to get out, one of the things that you don't want to find yourself doing is wavering in weird directions because you may just circle back. You know, that it's an unfamiliar area. So they teach you to put several points in a line and then walk to the next point, and you can see a further point, orient to that and pick a point beyond it and keep moving. So you've always got several points out there. In a sense, a list does that for you, only it's with your goals. So take an ambitious goal, break it into smaller parts, and then just go about knocking those things off the list, and you'll be surprised the kind of progress you can make.
Right? I like it.
It sounds low tech, but it's still very effective. I mean, Matt, you have a list. I bet you have several.
I do. I've got lists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Derek, you probably have no lists at all.
I have lists, but they're ones that I'm going to accomplish every day.
Yeah. Well, so you have workflows and habits.
Yeah.
Right. And that's there are lots of things that you could call it a workflow. You can call it a subroutine. You can call it a playbook. But it all kind of means something similar, which is I have a set of tasks that I need to accomplish in order to move the needle towards success.
My theory is if you can set it up so that you do the same things every day and you know you're going to end up where you want to. For example, invisible saving with retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
Never enters my checkbook. I can't spend it. And yet I know it's growing. So I know it's happening.
Yeah. The pay yourself first concept is essentially hidden within that. But again, that's just another name for the same thing.
And the habits.
Yes.
Get the exercise out of the way before you're awake. It just helps.
Yeah. Well, and the other is do the important things first, right? If you wait to do, procrastinating. That's another strange one.
I like it.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, in the remaining time, I want to do a couple things real quickly. One, Derek, I want to give you a chance one more time to just get your phone number out there.
Yes. Simmons Law, 541-677-7185, and we have tickets for Frozen tomorrow night.
Right, and if you have any kind of need for help with corporate entity structure, business law, that kind of stuff, Derek's a great resource, so give him a shout. Matt, how do they reach us for financial planning?
Yep, why don't you either call or text 541-375-0898 or go to the website at littlejohnfs.com.
Okay, and remember that stuff is... consults cost you nothing if you want to get an extra set of eyes on it. And for a future time, we'll talk about tax reviews, but that'll be later. But for now, we're out of time, so we got to run. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.